The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're very fortunate this month to be able to spend some time with Dr. Justin Wheeler from the Department of Gastroenterology at Primary Children's. Justin, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're really glad to have you here. So before we get started too much into this, let's talk a little bit about you. So my understanding is you went to medical school at The Ohio State University.
Correct. Yeah, I was going to correct you if you didn't throw it.
I was wavering. I was going to say an Ohio State University, but then I realized it's The Ohio State University. And then were you at Phoenix Children's for your residency?
Yes, Phoenix Children's for residency. My wife's from down there, so.
Oh, great. Great. And then back to Ohio for your fellowship, is that right? And at Cincinnati?
Yep, that's right.
How long have you been here?
I've been at Primary Children's for just about 3 years.
Great. Glad to have you here. And where are you from originally?
I'm actually from the Beehive State. So I grew up in Cache Valley area, so up north. And it was fun to come back home.
In the very lovely Cache Valley, right?
It is. It's a beautiful, beautiful.
It's a beautiful place. So glad to have you back then. Before we get too far into today's topic, so today we want to talk about abdominal pain. I'm sure that we can probably completely cover abdominal pain this week. Do you think that's likely?
You know, as a gastroenterologist, I might protest a little bit. But I'm sure hopefully we'll make some progress.
Before we go much farther, we should ask, are there any conflicts you need to report?
No conflicts of interest.
As time goes on, if there are any off-label uses of medications, I'm sure you'll warn us.
Correct. And we'll probably talk about some of those.
Okay. And do you find that you have any conflict, gastroenterology division at war with anyone right now?
Nope, we're at peace right now. So
you seem like a peaceful group. So we look to you for stability.
There's some serious Zen going around in the
yes. You know, right now we can use as much Zen as possible. So we want to talk about abdominal pain right now, which is, I think, something that anyone who practices probably any medicine at all, but clearly pediatrics, is going to deal with abdominal pain at some point. So what causes abdominal pain? It seems like that ought to be an easy answer, but it seems like it's more complicated the more I think about it.
Yeah, it's a great question. And as a pediatric gastroenterologist, it's at the forefront of my mind, and probably many pediatricians. So about 10% of all office visits are due to abdominal pain in the general pediatric setting. And then in a pediatric gastroenterologist clinic, about 50% of our visits have to do with functional GI disorders, pain, or some variant of pain with some other symptoms. Extremely common. And it won't surprise any parents or pediatricians out there, because everyone has had a kid or worked with a child who has abdominal pain. So it's very common. Your question of why does it happen? Why is it there? I wish we had the answers, but there are a lot of good hints and some interesting research coming out looking at that. So the GI tract is made up of many, many neurons. It's a big muscular tube with many, many neurons on it. Interestingly, there's as many nerves in your GI tract as a dog has in its brain, or two cat brains. So if you're a dog lover, you've got that on them. lots of nerves in there, or as many nerves as in your spinal cord. So lots of nerves, and it's a big muscle, and it's an interesting organ. You know, it is constantly getting exposed to foreign material that, you know, from things that you ingest, and it has to decide, what do I do with this foreign material? Do I digest it? Do I absorb it? Do I need to fight it off and kill it because it's an invasive bacteria or a parasite, or is it a food that I might be reacting to? And so it's a complicated, you know, dance between what you eat and your body deciding if it's good or bad. Those nerves in your GI tract, they can be activated and get twitchy and shoot off if there's too much distension or stretch, or if things are not moving through fast enough. So, you know, why kids get belly pain, it's such a multifaceted question, but it is it's a complicated organ with a lot of parts and a lot of nerves. And so I think that's why kids get pain often, is because there's nerves there to activate and send signals to your brain.
Well, I think it's safe to say that you get communication from your gut fairly frequently. And most of us have had the experience at some time or another that of feelings of discomfort. And so what we're looking at here in some ways is a continuum, I think, that that some people just have a lot of discomfort and some people have less.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Abdominal pain, they've done some interesting studies examining people's ability to tolerate pain in the GI tract. And irritable bowel syndrome, for example, is a subset of the functional GI disorders, and it's usually associated with either diarrhea or constipation, change in bowel habits. But it's also associated with pain. And they did a really interesting study where they took patients who had irritable bowel syndrome and they did anorectal manometry. Anorectal manometry is when a catheter is inserted into the rectum. It's as fun as it sounds, you know, it's just one of these tests you do, and they have a balloon on the end and the balloon is slowly inflated. And at some point, the rectum, as it's distended, you'll feel discomfort, urgency to stool and discomfort. And they did a very interesting study where they did this test where they inflated a rectal balloon and at the same time did a functional MRI of the brain examining pain centers. And they found individuals who have irritable bowel syndrome, their threshold for pain activation was much lower than an individual who didn't have IBS.
Oh, so interesting.
So the pain is real, and that's one of the messages that I hope that we address and that comes across, is that these kids who have pain, the pain is real, but it might not be a mucosal problem or an inflammatory problem. It might be more of like a muscle problem or a nerve problem, possibly exacerbated by a number of factors ranging from emotion and stress to diet.
Very interesting. So when somebody comes into the office complaining of abdominal pain, what are we trying to accomplish? I mean, that sounds simple-minded, but given that it's a very common thing, what are we trying to figure out?
Right. I think as providers, the first question is something dangerous going on, something that's going to harm this patient in the short term? And then the second thing is, what are we going to do about it to get this patient feeling better? So, you know, the step one is always determine, is this something that I need to act on quickly, and that's where a good history and physical come in. And then the second part is, how can I help this family and this patient feel better, and what can they expect?
As I've looked a little bit in preparing for this, one concept that seems to come up a lot is the issue of a therapeutic alliance. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, so sometimes I feel like we might have this view either as providers or as patients that when you visit the doctor, your problems will be solved, that you'll go out with an answer. And because abdominal pain is a multifaceted thing, especially functional pain where there isn't necessarily injury to the gut, you know, pain is there, but there's not something that's causing damage. Coming up with a therapeutic alliance or a team approach where both the patient is giving input and the physician is giving input into how you might manage their symptoms is a very important thing. If you're not on the same page and you're not both working towards a common goal and you don't have the same expectations up front, then you might run into a wall where you're trying to answer one question and they're looking for a different thing, and then you're not making progress in helping patients feel better. So it definitely is a team approach, and making sure that you're aware of that as a provider and the patient's aware of it will get you significant mileage down the road.
Yeah, good advice. Okay, so the patient's there, and we start taking a history. What things on a history ought to make me worry?
Right. So in GI, we have what we call red flag symptoms, mm-hmm. and there's a group. It's called the Rome group or the Rome criteria that was put together by a bunch of stodgy old gastroenterologists back in the day, and has been revised multiple times. But it basically refers to GI disorders that are functional in nature, meaning there's not organic disease necessarily. We're in the fourth iteration, so the Rome 4 criteria outlines these kind of red flag symptoms that you should be looking for as a provider. That might be a red flag that there's mucosal disease or some sort of injury. So the things that I would look for would be, first of all, weight loss or growth failure, the patients mm-hmm. with belly pain, or growth deceleration. Dysphagia would be a big one, or dynophagia, difficulty swallowing, diarrhea.
What's the difference between dynophagia and dysphagia?
Right, good question. So dysphagia is just kind of a more of an umbrella term for abnormal swallowing where it might feel funny or it's just not normal. Well, dysphagia is painful swallowing.
Okay.
We also want to look for diarrhea that is chronic. So maybe it's been having three or more poops a day for more than 2 weeks every single day. Blood in your stool. Maybe that they're waking up at night with diarrhea. Those would all be red flags. Dysuria is one to look for as well, or CVA tenderness. So is there renal involvement, urine involvement? And then extraintestinal symptoms like fever, rash, secondary amenorrhea, so if people are no longer having periods or lose their periods, ulcers in the mouth. Those are kind of the red flag symptoms that we look for.
Is there anything about the nature of the pain that should get my attention?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, they used to say that quadrant-specific pain was a red flag. So if you had quadrant pain, specifically or epigastric pain, they moved away from that a little bit because people can have functional pain in those areas. But I would say, you know, we're always thinking appendicitis, you know, is there gallbladder disease or something like that? And so thinking about that, of course, make, you know, if they have persistent right lower quadrant pain over McBurney's point, you're going to be worried. But quadrant specific pain, not necessarily. For functional pain, it classically is a colicky pain that kind of comes and goes. It's a dull ache, and sometimes they're fine and sometimes they're not. It can be acute in nature for sure and sharp in nature, but there's no one perfect description of pain. A functional abdominal pain can wear many, many hats. So there's not one specific thing that, aside from maybe point tenderness, that it always hurts in the exact same spot.
Okay, so you're saying that an organ with two cat brains worth of neurons can sometimes send difficult signals?
Absolutely, yeah. It doesn't localize pain very well. For as many nerves that are floating around your GI tract, it's not the smartest of organs.
Okay, is family history helpful?
It is, yeah. So if you have a family history of things like celiac disease, inflammatory bowel disease, autoimmune illness, a polyposis syndrome, those kinds of things absolutely would be a red flag as well.
Okay. How important is the psychosocial history to you? And it's interesting, that may be something that you approach differently than I do, because I may know this family pretty well.
Right, yeah. You know, this might be the most important aspect of any visit related to GI pain. There's an enormous overlap between psychosocial stressors and functional abdominal pain. So there's been some studies and they've shown anywhere from 40 to 85% of individuals who have chronic abdominal pain have some degree of anxiety or depression. And it's a chicken egg question, you know, came first, but there's absolute overlap. And so understanding what's going on in the patient's life, are they anxious? Are there stressors, good or bad? You know, is this a child who is a level 9 gymnast? Or is this a child who is stressed out because a difficult social situation? Being aware of that will get you significant mileage in getting and addressing what might be an underlying contributing factor.
And sometimes you find out surprising things when you bother to ask the question. You know,
right.
what current stressors there may be. And when you go to secret gastroenterology school, what are the questions that I might not think to ask? Are there important questions that you wish people would ask more?
Yeah. You know, here in Utah, there's a lot of eosinophilic esophagitis, or EOE, and we diagnose this very frequently in GI clinic. And sometimes, especially in younger kids, they present with belly pain. And many, many times I ask the question, do you ever feel like food gets stuck, or are you an allergic individual? And kids start saying yes to some of these things. They're slow eaters. They have to drink a lot. And then parents' eyebrows go up because they're just not aware of it. Mm-hmm. Dysphagia is an interesting, or difficulty swallowing is an interesting question that you could always slide into your quiver of questions.
And does that fit with an atopic history generally?
Most of the time, you know, either a family history of atopy, or else the child for sure, you know, asthma, eczema, seasonal allergies, and then male gender is oftentimes a risk factor, three times more common in males than females.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah.
Okay, so we've asked a lot of questions. Now we're going to do a physical exam. Is there a gestalt? I mean, when you walk in the room, is there something that makes you worry more if you see it? I know that's a broad question. You don't have to answer it, but I was just wondering if there's anything that you walk in and say, oh, we're in trouble.
I think looking at the interaction between the parent and the child. Honestly, sometimes treating things like celiac disease or inflammatory bowel disease in many aspects is more straightforward and less nuanced than treating functional GI disorders. The interplay of emotion between a provider, you know, a parent and a child is very complicated in and can be a huge contributing factor. And when you walk in the room and you can tell that the relationship between the parent and child is either over-dependent or else oppositional, you know you're in for a ride.
Okay. Now, I'm doing the physical exam. What things on the physical exam should make me worry?
I guess the question is, what would make you worried? What should you worry about? You know, if worry is, am I missing something dangerous? Am I missing something that could cause harm? It would be some of those red flag symptoms. You know, you do a belly exam, if a child's having diarrhea, mm-hmm. and they have significant pain over the right lower quadrant. You look at their, you do an external anal exam, for example, and you see skin tags, that kind of thing obviously should raise red flags that there's something inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, something going on. Those would be the big things. An exam of the abdomen, unfortunately, it's somewhat limited. You know, we have a few organs we can feel, the liver, we can feel the spleen. There's some we can't feel. The pancreas is hiding out back there somewhere. Some say we don't even know if it exists. You know, that pancreas is in there, but you can't really feel it. And same with the gallbladder. You know, those are hard to examine sometimes. And the bowel itself is just in a giant sack flapping around for the most part. So it's not always the easiest of exams. You know, feeling for impacted stool on an abdominal exam, of course, is important. But, you know, the exam itself sometimes doesn't get you huge mileage. One of the things it can do, though, is provide a source of reassurance for parents. So you should never underestimate the respect and the value that a parent will place on a provider, you know, placing hands on a child's abdomen and doing a careful, thorough exam. We've all had children who will jump off the bed when you touch their belly, even with light touch, who in all other aspects is a well child, and they're just having a lot of belly pain. And sometimes doing things like being sneaky and listening with a stethoscope to their heart as they're lying down, and then just popping down to their belly and giving gentle pressure as you're listening. And they're just fine with that, but gentle pressure with the hands sends them off the bed. Sometimes just pointing that out to the patient and to the parent and say, you know, I think you're very nervous about anything touching your belly, but I think, you know, this is reassuring. And sometimes that kind of a finding can be really assuring for parents.
Are there aspects of the physical exam I might not normally do, but might give me some information?
You know, I think is a pediatrician in the office, making sure that they have bowel sounds, that they're there, and making sure that, you know, if they're reporting constipation is part of this, or, you know, you're digging into their history and you're finding that maybe they're on the constipated side or diarrhea, you know, don't be afraid to talk about, we need to take a quick peek at your bottom and make sure you know, perianal disease, things like that. Making sure you look in the mouth, see if there's little aphthous ulcers that patients might have. Look at their dental health, you know. What is the family doing to take care of this child in general? And
what am I looking for with dental health?
Well, you know, sometimes I look in a child's mouth and they have caries, or there's kind of poor dental hygiene, and it's not necessarily pointing towards a GI disease happening, maybe bad reflux or something, potentially in rare cases, but it might be more of a way you could approach what's going on in this kid's diet. Is he going to bed with juice every night? You know, what other things are going on that could be contributing to his abdominal pain?
Oh, very helpful. Okay, so now we decide about doing any labs. Are there any labs that everyone should have?
No, there's not. So there's not a one-size-fits-all, unfortunately, with kids with belly pain. You know, if they come in and they don't have red flag symptoms, the official recommendations is that you need a very minimal lab workup. To make a diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome, functional abdominal pain syndrome, it's a clinical diagnosis. You don't have to have lab work. There are recommendations that you should consider. For example, if a child has irritable bowel syndrome symptoms of IBS, so change in bowel habits with either constipation, diarrhea, or alternating back and forth between the two, they actually recommend considering a celiac screen. So in a large study in Italy, they found that there's a fourfold increase in celiac disease in both children and in adults with IBS-like symptoms. So not every child who has IBS has to have a celiac screen, and it doesn't have to be at the first visit if you want, you know, if you need to tease it out. But if there is any concern for that, that would be something that...
With diarrhea or constipation.
Right, yeah, diarrhea or constipation. Additionally, stool guaiac occasionally is considered. That's an exquisitely sensitive test, and it can be challenging to obtain. And if a child is on the constipated side and has a little fissure or a hemorrhoid and there's a tiny amount of blood, it might come back positive, and then you just have to decide how to interpret that. So there's not an across the board, there in the past there have been recommendations that you get a stool coag, but that's not an across the board recommendation at this point. And then you just have to decide what else you do to help families come to a point that they're okay with the diagnosis, that you're okay with the diagnosis. Do you need to do screening labs, a blood count to look for anemia or signs of chronic inflammation, you know, things to consider.
When would you decide to look at the liver, for instance, with either transaminases or bilirubin or anything like that?
Very seldom do you need to do that for someone with functional abdominal pain. If they're overweight or obese, as a gastroenterologist, you know, we start thinking about things like fatty liver disease.
Uh-huh.
You might do a screening to look and see if they might be at risk for that. But it very, very rarely is helpful for chronic abdominal pain.
C-reactive protein or sed rate helpful?
Similarly, there haven't been, large studies haven't shown that those have borne out to be helpful, especially in the absence of red flag symptoms.
How about imaging? Who needs imaging? And if so, what should they get?
Yeah, good question. Imaging is kind of a similar answer where it depends, unfortunately. You know, kids who have postprandial nausea, who might have a risk, have some obesity or strong family history of gallstones, or maybe, you know, other risk factors for gallstones, you might think about getting an ultrasound. You don't want to discount the importance of looking for things like ovarian cysts or things like that in the right patient population. But in general, imaging is not recommended. If a patient is having vomiting or chronic reflux along with the pain, you might look for anatomic abnormalities with an upper GI study, look for a hiatal hernia or something like that. But in general, imaging is typically not helpful or recommended for functional GI disorders.
Sometimes some people have recommended relying on maybe doing some diagnostic intervention. So I think the most common thing is asking people to bring in a symptom diary, which seems like there may be some help, at least in being able to systematize what's going on. Some people have also recommended a trial of stopping foods, which seems like it's a difficult thing to recommend. Any comment on that, whether dairy or wheat or anything else?
Yeah, good question. And I like that you referred to it as a diagnostic intervention, because it really can be that for families. Things like removing foods like dairy or wheat or the low FODMAP diet. FODMAP stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. These are just fermentable sugars. There have been research looking at using diets like that for treating irritable bowel syndrome specifically. And there are patients who have had great relief from doing these elimination diets where you take away the foods. The most important thing you have to remember is that dietary intervention such as a low FODMAP diet is a huge commitment for families.
Yes, it is.
It's very restrictive, and it can present, you know, it can always cause other symptoms downstream or problems downstream as families attempt to follow these diets. So if you're not familiar with it, it might not be the best just to send a patient off to the internet or to download an app and have them try and follow it on their own. That could open a rabbit hole of unnecessary challenges for you and for the patient.
So you see some of these patients who I've seen and I haven't been able to figure out what's going on, and I send them to see you. Is there anything, any general trends of things that you wish people have done differently before they send them to you, either more or less, that we should have done?
I think the hardest thing is setting appropriate expectations. Sometimes families talk to providers, and it might be family interpretation more than anything of what's said, but sometimes they arrive with an expectation of the next step is an invasive procedure such as endoscopy. They show up ready to have a camera evaluate their mucosa, and oftentimes that's not the right answer. And so making sure that families understand that just because you're going to see a gastroenterologist doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to get a bunch of other tests. Instead, it might be discussing, this is an expert who has experienced looking for maybe things that might be unusual, but could also help you feel better if things that we've tried haven't worked.
Mm-hmm. And it seems a lot of times when we send somebody to see someone like you, a lot of times what we're looking for is either an endorsement or you know, potentially a correction of what we've done, but I don't think any of us mind if you say, yeah, I think that all looks fine. And clearly from your point of view, there are things that you can teach people to do that, that may come more from your expertise, but we always appreciate the input.
Yeah. And I think families appreciate that too. And, you know, usually what happens is a family might come in with an expectation that something invasive might happen, or there's X, Y, or Z is going to happen, probably just from their own interpretation of prior discussions. But I think at the end of the day, any parent just wants their child to feel better. That's what they want. And right. However we get to that, ultimately, even if it means trying some interventions and coming to finding some triggers that might be making it worse, they'll be happy at the end of the day, as long as we can get their child feeling very better and they know that there's nothing dangerous going on.
Yeah, excellent point. You know what I think we ought to do? I think we ought to talk about next week, maybe some things that we can do to help treat people who have abdominal pain.
I think that's a great idea.
Deal? Okay. Thanks so much for sharing your time and expertise. For those of you listening, please remember to send your questions to questions@thecurb.com. It's always helpful to get questions. It helps us to refine what we've talked about, and we'll look forward to talking again next week. Thanks, Justin.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, thecurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.